Tonight, I am so very happy to have Benjamin Maris here to speak on his practice and his resulting work. I had the pleasure of meeting Benny, as he was introduced to me, at an opening at the Zier Smith Gallery in New York last January. We had one of the most genuine art opening conversations I could have hoped for. Benny told me very little about his own work, but he was extremely free with his suggestions on what I needed to see while I was in New York. And just his overall enthusiasm for what he saw happening in art at the time. In fact, it was Benny who introduced me to the work of Martha Tuttle's. He told me about a show, and I went to see it, and I was impressed. And, of course, invited her to come and give a lecture last spring. And Benny's tip was good. Martha met the expectation and gave, as many of you know, a really beautiful lecture last spring. We also discussed things beyond art, and needless to say, I was impressed with Benny Maris, which led me to find out more about him and his as an artist and his work, and then, of course, led to tonight's presentation. Currently based in Brooklyn, Benjamin Maris received a BA from the University of Boston in 2002 and an MFA in 2007 from Glasgow School of Art in Glasgow, the UK. And has been making his way as an artist ever since. He was most recently in the exhibition The Secret Life of Plants, curated by Letty Churchman at Murray Guy Gallery in New York, which happens to be one of my favorite galleries, so I consider that another connection. And solo exhibitions over just the past year, 6 years, include Ecstatic Insistence, in which all of the I's are exclamation marks, at the 2010 Amsterdam Art Fair. And then also in 2010, Happy as an Asteroid. And in 2014, Stranger at Diet Gallery in Miami, as well as, okay, let's see if I can say this so it makes sense. Always, always. Always, always. At the Jeff Bailey Gallery in Hudson, New York, and How Forests Think. So How Wooded Areas, Forests Think. At the Batat Contemporary in Montreal, Canada. And some of you may know Benny's work from the 2013 exhibition Outside the Lines, which was curated by Dean, can you help me with his last name? Diderco. And Dean Diderco actually has a connection with Tom Sachs, who was here just a few weeks ago. But he curated the show at the CAM in Houston that Benny was a part of, and it was a big, very successful show. And in an essay that references the image that so many of you are familiar with if you've seen my promotional materials for tonight's lecture, Diderco wrote, quote, during a residency at the Banff Center in 2012, Maris produced a pivotal series of works in which he photographed his painted forearm reaching into dramatic landscapes where he recorded sensual and mimetic scenarios. The images approach abstraction as a way to engage and make sense of the world. Maris's sensibility is as organic and fluid as it is rigorous, as filled with wonder as it is informed by the sense of scientific reason. And it is consistently navigates between such positions, seeing them not as oppositional, but natural and intimately connected. So with that, please join me in welcoming Benny Maris.
All right. Hello. Thank you so much for coming tonight. It's a great pleasure to be here in Fort Worth. And I feel similarly lucky, as Terry mentioned, about our serendipitous run-in last January, and loved our instant connection that we made when we started talking about our passion for art and kind of putting our fingers up to see which ways the winds were blowing and what we wanted to see and what we perceived to be going on around us. So it's my deepest honor to be here with you all tonight. I thought I would, I guess Terry mentioned a little bit about my background. I come from Boise, Idaho, is where I grew up, and I moved to Boston, Massachusetts after high school, and have had a kind of consistent migratory pattern since then. About every 6 years, I get pretty itchy feet and need to move along to a new place. So I've been making art in Idaho and Boston and Scotland and Amsterdam and now New York City as part of my kind of meandering. So I think it's nice to have that as a little context as you see the way that the work has developed. It's informed by this kind of consistent migration that I've just been inclined to keep going. And I've been in New York City 6 years now, so I have no idea what's going to happen next year. But I thought I'd start with a image of a piece that is and continues to be a kind of pivotal turning point in my relationship to abstraction. I've maintained a really passionate commitment to abstract painting and have a rigorous studio practice that's kind of constant and ongoing, and it's my place where I go work out and stretch and do my figuratively and sometimes literally, but figuratively to just kind of process the visual world, move paint around, keep my hands busy and learning and curious, and keep my eyes tuned up. But there, this was a piece called Being There, and it happened in 2010 in Scotland. And it was around a time when I was really wanting more from the experience of painting. I love the contemplative experience of standing in front of a painting on a wall, and the kind of type of immersion that allows, to treating the painting as a window into a world and a window into the soul of the artist who made it, and enjoying what the painting reflected back in that experience, and wanted to kind of play with that idea of what lies behind a painting and what kind of window it could actually be into another world or place, or what type of kind of transcendental opportunity would be there. So I did a secret renovation to the gallery and didn't tell anyone. At the curator of the exhibition was the only one who knew, but no one in the audience knew that I had cut a hole behind this painting. And about 40 minutes into the opening, as everyone was just kind of lingering around what looked like an ordinary painting show, I ran and dove through the painting and had engineered a secret exit out of the building and was able to just disappear and not return. So this painting started to inspire me to think about the physicality and my body and the kind of deeper layers of abstraction that might be available in a painting if they're activated in a specific way. So I'll begin to move through some slides, and we'll kind of look at what happened in the studio and at around this time, the paintings that were happening in the studio and the kind of slow chronological transition to where things are at today. So during my master's studies in painting in Glasgow, and up to that painting since I was 15 years old up to about 25 years old, I'd really connected to the old masters of abstraction who were kind of using abstraction as a tool to distill the experience of the modern world around them, and the modernizing world around them that was becoming increasingly dynamic and musical and was intermixing through mass transportation and more visibility around the world. People were able to see so much of the world. And I think that was one of the kind of incredible impulses that led to the explosion of abstraction in the early 20th century and through the 20th century. And so I firmly situated myself in a kind of continuum of that type of attitude, the one of a younger person who I can still remember my pre-internet brain and miss it sometimes, but kind of wanting to process the what felt like a really maximal world around me into scenarios and painting that could hold some of that energy and dynamism of the techno world, the burgeoning techno world around us. And took a spirit of maximalism to these and wanted to the paintings to be able to hold the resonance and intensity of the feeling of the world, and also the way that the world was starting to change how it looked. We really started to experience the world so much through screens and backlit media sources, where the light inside of the imagery the light exudes from within when we look at images on a screen, and I wanted my paintings to reflect a lot of that. So this is a moment where I started to incorporate gradients into my painting, which I think are one of the definitive qualities of screen media. They're able to display and show us color in profoundly luminous gradients. So, and almost all of that media that we see has gone through some type of technology like Photoshop or an editing software of some kind that ramps its luminosity and its contrast up. So our eyes have acclimated and evolved to read this type of imagery constantly without us knowing about it through advertisements and television and just all of our media. But that was a key moment for me, was to recognize that and start to build those gradients into all of my paintings around this time. And to keep using the motifs of architecture and patternation and combinations of access and total density in these paintings, so that they sat in some kind of almost uneasy position with the world around them, like a I'm not sure how long you'd want to look at this. So color has always been just a wildly deep, infinite exploration with wild powers that I almost dare not try to explain or speak of. I find it really intimidating to talk about color, but love using it rampantly and abundantly and smashing it together with it with other colors to just see what happens, and letting all different kinds of stimulus, visual stimuli, influence what type of color dynamics I'm hoping for. I love looking at fashion. I love looking at vegetation and botanic gardens, the outdoor world, the indoor world. I like just going, you know, crazy with the knobs in Photoshop and turning up everything and solarizing things and doing all, like, trying to make the sort of computer wig out by overloading colors. So I'm very undiscriminating when it comes to color use around this time, but constantly setting all of the color in motion through the use of the gradient. So color's never static at any point in a lot of the paintings in this period. It's constantly moving, cycling through to another color, to another type of resonance with the color around it. I think it's interesting to talk about the artists that you're looking at the time. Around this time, I like to call it forming an affinity group of other artists. You can kind of conveniently pick four or five artists whose work sort of rhymes and resonates with what you're hoping to achieve, and you can kind of bring on board a little bit of their power to kind of think about it as affinity group, and to think about what you might be offering to those types of artists. So I put together a funny affinity group for this moment where I was thinking of Kandinsky and Hans Hoffman and Philip Taff and Al Held and Toma Apps. And I think that group was assembled because of the power of color, overstated and understated, in all of their paint at different moments in their careers. I guess it's necessary with some people who've painted for 50 to 60 years to kind of identify a period. I guess this would be late Kandinsky, when his work was much more graphic and kind of carnivalesque, psychedelic, and Hans Hoffman just throughout his life spoke a language of magic, like he just actively used the word magic to describe the process of creation, and while simultaneously maintaining a pretty rigorous Bauhaus mind and teaching regimen, it was very exciting to hear somebody letting the word magic infiltrate that type of practice. Philip Taff was building these decorative optical patterns and not afraid of ornamentation and decoration and sort of decadent density in the paintings. And Toma Apps is able to articulate just nuanced shadow and depth and the perception that something is happening, but you're not exactly sure what the verb is to describe what's happening. So maybe that's an affinity group
to think about at that point. And here is where I moved to New York City, and my studio shrunk, and I promptly got into the studio and got started working and got in an accident at work and broke 5 bones in my right hand and needed to paint left-handed for about 6 months at this moment. And it really changed my paint handling and was frustrating in a lot of ways, but also very informative and changed my attitude about precision and control, still incorporating those ideas into the work, but they became very different when I was working left-handed. And these are some of the paintings that started happening around that time I was moving to New York. Gradients are still happening in the paintings, but my ability to kind of keep a nice smooth surface on the painting was lost to my left hand, and that was fine. And one way I started to utilize the messiness and a way to sort of control the messiness in a way on these was I started using these paintings as almost like a lithography bed. I started pulling prints off of these paintings. And it served to keep the paint very thin on the surface of these. These are on wooden panels, which brought a lot of transparency into the painting that hadn't been there before, which opened up the space in them and allowed it started to induce some of that media light that I was seeking through when thinking about screens and backlit technology. And it would lead to this type of work was the byproduct of the work that came before it. So as these types of works would build their layers, I was constantly pulling prints off of the wood panels onto, this is cotton rag, kind of heavy rag paper that could stand up to hundreds of touches and contacts with other prints, my palettes, the wooden panels. And these were just about accumulation and just catching paint, not wasting any paint. So these hundreds of these pieces of paper started kind of circulating around the studio and just getting stacked, and they would act as nearly as my rags as I would go. So I'd kind of paint a gradient, pull a print off it, take the masking tape away, pull another print, touch those prints to other prints, and by the end of a session there would be 200 prints out on the floor. And in that time, I was researching another aspect of color that I'd been really curious about, pearlescence. And I was curious how pearlescence happened inside of a shell. And it's a combination of a sticky fluid that's produced by the animal that's living inside of it and a grain of sand and then just wave activity and constant friction. Constant contact of that grain of sand to that fluid to the inside of the shell, and it just washes itself over and over and over. So I began to imagine these as my pearls that I was making in my studio, that if I could just make enough contact, these would become pearlescent. So they're a kind of humble, feeble attempt at pearlescence through persistence in the studio. And here was an instance of hanging about 120 of those pearls together into a field of pearls at an exhibition in Montreal. So that approach towards abstraction through kind of mimicking a natural process would inform and continues to inform my work constantly. In fact, it's what I seek out to inform my work, to sort of mimic nature so as to better abide in nature. And the pearls led to these totems where I was so inspired by utilizing mimicking a natural process, and had thought about these the ways that when I used my body to activate paintings, it had given them a very exciting new dimension. So it led to wanting to give bodies to the paintings, and to think about anima and animus and how spirit inhabits something. And I think a body is a vessel of some kind is really where the spirit resides when we think of spirit and the possibility for it and the magical possibility for it. And so these were logs that I would collect on hikes and walks and adventures and around the city. And they would come in and start to get similar treatments to what the pearls were getting. And meanwhile, on the panels above them would be this place where I could continue to hone my abstract painting and think about new ideas about abstraction and think about new ways that the world looked and was changing the way it looked. So it felt like a type of activation of the body, a kind of yogic, if you will, kind of quality to make sculpture and to animate that sculpture, to give it a potential feeling that it has capacity for dynamic movement or personality, spirit of some kind, and then this kind of thinking head that is a bit more intellectualized, a bit more a place of refinement, maybe, and of conceptual thinking. So these works saw a few different iterations, trying to think about figure and ground and relationships to classical painting and figuration. This one, I cut the birch tree to exactly the height of the bottom of my chin, and the painting was exactly the height of my head, so it had this one-to-one correspondence with my body. And the scale of the painting behind it is exactly my kind of largest rectangle that I can make when I stretch myself out. So I have maintained a connection of scale through my body, and have let these, and hope to continue to let these materials flow, come back from outside, inside, and then go from inside back outside. And there's a few more of those. I think to call them totems also is to give them the potential for spirit to kind of the capacity for a type of magic to be embodied in them. And meanwhile, I've maintained a leap at a chance to paint a surface, a big wall surface somewhere, to kind of engage with the architecture and the built environment around us, to kind of, in this case, this painting mirrored the traffic flow around it. It mirrored a convergence of intersections and the kind of physical structure of the things built around it, and had this lovely two-ness of those two panels set back, formerly windows in the wall. So it was a way to it's very exciting to paint outdoors. So this is something I persist in and try to find opportunities for every chance I get. And I think every space and place is an opportunity to do something different. This was a space, this was a building in Glasgow that was slated to be demolished. And I had always dreamed of a total painting, a total four or even five dimensional painting. I'm not sure what the fifth dimension is. But I did find out that the word quintessence is related to the fifth dimension. So quintessential is the fifth essence. So that's a bit of word play. But anyway, this was a total painting where every surface of the gallery, walls, floor, ceiling, doors, hardware, every single thing was painted and connected to compositionally throughout. So it was, when once inside it, you became a form in the painting. You were an activated component of the painting. To be an audience member was to be in the painting. And here's a painting that was at Kunsthal Rotterdam that sat adjacent to a gallery where a film was screening with Johann Sebastian Bach's Fugue in D minor was playing. And it's a piece that has a really beautiful counterpoint melody to it. And this, and so I let that counterpoint melody and the music that would be heard while seeing the piece inform how the piece interacted with the architecture of this building. This building is rather despised by the city of, at least the citizens with bum knees and hips. There's no flat surfaces in this museum. Every floor, including in the main galleries, is ramped in this museum. So it's a fairly uneasy museum to traverse. And so this painting performs a straight line across the top of it. It's a kind of spirit level that starts at the top of the hallway, the ramp at the front of the building, and traverses the entire length of the building and finishes at this guardrail that looks like a beautiful needle going on the record playing that beautiful Bach piece. And then I'll transition to my latest and my ongoing series of work that Terry mentioned that started in 2012, which is called Another. It's another chiasma or chiasmus, which is a poetic kind of device or situation where two words that are the same, kind of sometimes homonyms, sometimes not, are situated side by side. So always, and another, and root could be potential chiasmas. But that was in that poetic device, there was, it is reflected the mimetic nature and what I've called sympathetic magic that informs the manner that these pieces are made in. And sympathetic magic was a term that came about in the kind of end of the Middle Ages to describe magic that was two types of sympathetic magic. There's imitative sympathetic magic and contagious sympathetic magic. And contagion would indicate that once something has come in contact with something else, it's kind of its destiny is tied. They're tied to each other. That you, once you've made contact with someone or something, that you're bound forever. And imitative is the type of magic that would inform a lot of how modern medicine came to be. When, for example, you saw, it was thought that walnuts were good for people's brains because they looked like a brain. Or if something looked like a phallus, it would be good for men's sexual health. Or that was the kind of abiding principle in nature, would be that eat what looks like what you hope to heal and what you hope to act on. So with that principle in mind, I set about trying to find a way for my abstract paintings to relate directly to nature and be made outdoors in nature. So it was a plein air approach to abstract painting. And I would take my paints with me in my backpack and hike for a few hours and observe the vegetation and the topography and the changing weather of the day, the lighting scenarios in different places, and then would sit down and paint for a few hours on my arm and then walk around for a few more hours with that painting on my arm and just use my camera and my body to capture a lot of exploratory, improvisational movement in the landscape, where I could try to find ways to interact with each and you know, with all components of the landscape. There's many components of the landscape as the painting might kind of harmonize or rhyme with. And it would involve pointing and bending and pushing and kind of pulling and trying to kind of move like something was moving or fit into a scenario. There were a lot of different types of ways where the landscape became very instructive. Like the less I tried to impose myself, the more the landscape would sort of just show me what to do or how to do it, or just observe what it was doing so that I could do it also, or show it that I was capable of doing it also. Or it frequently feels like an exchange. Like there's me and our kind of instinctual human otherness when we're outside. Like I don't think I'm a mountain, but I kind of want to be a mountain, and maybe a mountain kind of wants to be a human, but don't want to anthropomorphize it too much. But like maybe we can just rhyme with each other and imitate each other so as to kind of collapse a boundary between us, make both of us become more porous through this exploratory process of imitation. And I've tried to do this type of these paintings in the built environment in the city, but there's really no 90 degree angles anywhere on our hands or you can get close, and that the closeness is really it's interesting to get close, but there's I haven't felt compelled to make this work in the city. It's work that's always taken me far outside. Occasionally there are humans in there. But it's been a place where I can take a lot of the ideas from 20 years of painting indoors in the studio and take them outside and sort of test them one idea at a time in this different place where the rules of painting are completely different. I'll never forget the first day of my first ever painting class in college, and I had taken a painting from one building to another, and my painting teacher said, never take your paintings outside uncovered. She's like, because they will just look really, they'll look really disappointing compared to the to the world around. You know, paintings are made for white spaces and should only be viewed there. And I thought that was really funny. And I, of course, always want to see paintings outside now because of that. It's a great thing to kick against. So I've pursued many residency opportunities over the years and just initiated a lot of trips just to explore new places, discover new landscapes, and so in order to generate this work. And I've found it to be a really dynamic and effective mnemonic tool. My memory has really improved. The atmosphere and feeling and lie of the land in a lot of these places remains very vivid, having had this type of engagement where I look at it, respond to it, and then go participate in it and try to imitate it. It's really helped me to remember and feel more intimate to these places that I've traveled to, connects to. I heard that there was a neuroscientist in here last week talking about potentially some of the potential for empathy to be an embodied characteristic of humans, not necessarily a learned behavior, but something that's built, hardwired into our brains. And I've looked into that a lot, and I've had it reinforced through this type of work that there is to, it sounds quite intuitive to say that to imitate someone or something is to better understand it and to feel like you have the capacity for empathy towards it. But the empathy for the, I mean, it's there's always, the neuroscientists would say there's a danger in anthropomorphizing, but I'm not sure what the danger is. Like I don't know why it would be a problem to be empathic with a stone or a tree or a mountain or a river or stream. So I don't have all the language for that, but I do deeply sense that engaging in this type of behavior has opened me towards a new capacity for relating to the natural environment, something about it, something about the principles that inform how it was built are the same principles that are how we are all built. And to connect abstract painting to that type of empathic emotional response is very exciting and very dynamic, and makes me excited to continue to pursue this work. It feels like it's something that can and will keep going for some time to come. And I hope it's the type of work that will continue to take me to faraway places and corners of this beautiful planet that we're on. Some of the places that you've seen so far are the Canadian Rockies and Idaho. This is in the Mojave Desert. There's been some photographs from Israel and the Negev Desert and in southern Jordan. This is up in the Catskills in upstate New York. This is out in Montauk at the tip of Long Island. This one is in Joshua Tree. Someone described this one the other day as 3D onomatopoeia, and I really liked that turn of phrase. And I really like, similarly to thinking about chiasma and that poetic terminology, I think the role of language play and poetics is really something that activates this work, that gives it its kind of playful and sensual and not immediately serious on the surface, but gives it a some depth and kind of bounce in your head. I've experienced frostbite twice making this work in cold places when the paint freezes to my arm. So that's pretty uncomfortable. So with this ongoing series, it gives me a real renewed energy for years now, several years now, to be back inside in the studio as well. Now I relate to my painting practice as having an indoor and outdoor quality to it. So and they both need each other. They're symbiotic. Things I learn by painting outdoors inform indoors and vice versa. The things I playing with and experimenting and new materials end up getting put on my arm and tested out in the landscape and brought back inside. So they feed each other in a really dynamic and constructive way. It also helped me to break down an artificial boundary in that I was taught through education about a difference between abstraction and figuration in painting. It always seemed like there were two camps, and you were in one or the other, and that boundary is gone now. I think that kind of you can't have one without the other in a lot of regards. So on a given day, I'll end up producing 150 to 250 photographs of just, you know, movement exploration that feel like that have a connection to dance and choreography that I haven't articulated an awful lot at this point, but this work did really begin percolating at the exact time that I fell in love with dancing and going out dancing and dancing to house music and techno music and funk, and just there's that switch that flipped on in my own physicality and desire for what I did with my body kind of coincided with what I was doing with my body and my painting at the same time. So there's a strong connection to dance and correlation to dancing that's present in this work. And some people have asked if this work is a documentation of performance. I don't think of it that way. I don't think of me out performing for my sort of, I guess it would be performing for the camera in these types of scenarios, and who I imagine might be on the other side of it once I printed the photograph. But it's not, I would stop short of calling it performative, although it has a, if you were to walk upon a person out doing this kind of strange behavior, you might think that they were performing, but no. I think that's the last slide that I brought. So maybe I have said a lot, but I would love to field any questions and feedback that anyone might have for me. Yes?
It's very interesting work. And when you started drawing the left side, did you feel the brain was working?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Very immediately, and in a way that compelled me to, I took a lot of notes after all of working with my left hand, and would leave myself little voice memos to describe the feeling and some of the different types of thinking that I was having during the process of making a mark, because it was my thoughts were different than when I was painting with my right hand. So I would try to record them and still have those, that thinking. And now I actively use my left hand because of it in the studio. If I want to, not just to achieve a certain type of mark, like, or to do something that feels unselfconscious. It does still produce something unselfconscious, but it also makes me think something that I couldn't have predicted thinking. So I find it a really useful tool. I don't recommend breaking your right hand to do it, but yeah, that was a very dynamic turning point for me. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes?
Given what you were talking about, empathy, do you think of these as self-portraits on some level?
I had a little bit of a nervousness that they might read that way at the beginning, and I'm not sure what made me self-conscious about that. Maybe just having painted abstractly for so long, I was so invested in portraying some type like universality, diminishing my presence and kind of speaking about a kind of more massive presence and continuum. And now that I've been doing it for a few years, I hardly see myself in them. I think that there's some of that universality comes through the first, just a first person quality. We all know, we all have like this first person, we know what our hand looks like in front of our face. And so there, I think that that condition of them is what allows them to not just be self-portraits. If they get read as a self-portrait, that's, I can't help it, but I don't think of them that way. Yes? In the white shirt, sorry.
All right. Your word chiasma, how do you spell that?
C-H-I-A-S-M-A.
That's an anatomic term.
Anatomic?
Yeah. It's it refers. It's a neuroanatomy term. It's also a term from genetics.
Oh wow!
And in both cases, what it really means is a point where there's crossover. So in the brain, where the optic nerves meet and send out their projections to each side of the occipital cortex so that images from the right eye and from the left eye get mixed and go to both sides.
Wow.
And then in genetics, it's where chromosomes meet and exchange DNA information. So both of them have this idea of an overlapping, a crossing, and that's where the word comes in Greek.
Wow.
A crossing. But I don't know, it's an interesting idea, the idea that a chiasm is a point where there's sharing.
Yeah.
But I don't get it, what you said, this idea of comparison of homonyms.
Yeah, I'm really happy to learn about that and excited to discover it. I think what I was getting at was I came upon the term through a writer named Timothy Morton, who has really made his mark on the world of philosophy in object-oriented ontology, and how he's really getting down to the kind of trying to get to the molecular level of how meaning is generated. He has the gift of gab, so he looks a lot at language. And in his book about his book is called Realist Magic, and he uses this metaphor through the book called the strange stranger. And he calls that term strange stranger chiasma, and it's informed a lot of my language play that I incorporate into my titling, like another, another, and always, always. So his strange stranger is where I started to use that word chiasma and think about what that doubling and there is a kind of overlapping quality that I think I can sort of have a thought picture that reminds me of what you're talking about inside the brain.
Yeah, I get a feeling of that too. It'd be something to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. Chiasmus, when I've looked up that word, and that one becomes...
Actually, chiasma is one.
Uh-huh.
Chiasmata is two.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Cool. Wow. Yes.
You said a moment ago that was not necessarily a self-portrait. You don't see it as a self-portrait. But on the other hand, could you see it as more of you than it would be if it were actually a picture of you standing beneath that Joshua tree. In other words, it seems like you are constantly transcending boundaries so that you can be part of it. And it's not so much that's a Joshua tree and that's you. That is you and the Joshua tree together. So could it be fair to say that that picture is more of you than it would be if we saw you standing there in the experience that you had?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess so. I guess it's very expressionistic, I think, the impulse to create a painting is a really expressionistic impulse. So in that image, you do see that I've made a painting that is indicative of something about my emotional state or intentions or qualities that day, something about what I was feeling and wanting to emanate from me by putting it on me. So there are a lot of decisions that I did make to get to the point of that. And I think that I haven't done anything to diminish them. Yeah, you could certainly see it that way. And I hope that it's maybe it's a counterbalancing then that occurs through the act of imitation, that maybe in this case imitation, where the tree's doing the same thing as I am, or I'm doing the same thing as it is, and in that exchange of us both doing as each other are, there's less importance on me specifically.
Did somebody else have a question?
No, did that kind of address that?
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. Terry?
Based on that, is there a reason, I mean, other than maybe just practically how you could interact with the image in nature and mimic it, is there any other reason for using the arm and the hand as opposed to some other part of you?
Yeah, definitely. I think our hands are our primary source of intelligence about the world. They're our most nimble and acute, and they're how we. They have so much sensual capacity to input and output, and they execute our thoughts, and they also kind of inform our thinking by being the first thing to make contact. So with that, I think that the hand is it's also the part of our body we're able to manipulate most articulately and diversely. I've tried making these on my legs and it is significantly less dynamic.
It also makes me think of the hands in like the caves of Lascaux, and you know, the whatever that was that symbolized, the idea of the hand,
yeah,
as being a way to identify that you were there.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, that impulse in the cave to indicate something about presence, and maybe that's that something about that primariness. This is the contact is capable through this part of us. This part of us is maybe our, you know, it could indicate that it's our great communicative strategy. It resides in our hands. Something to that effect. Yes?
Are you familiar with a series of photographs called The Red Sofa?
No. What are they?
Some years ago, probably the 70s, photographer took a red sofa and would introduce it to various landscapes and have various people sit on it and do a series of photographs based on that red sofa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea here is somewhat the same. Your arm hand are alien in texture, largely, to the material or the subject matter of the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
So they both provide that kind of contrast, where they are, in the case of your hand, you're doing an imitative gesture to some degree, and yet your arm hand is also alien in terms of texture to the thing it's imitating, so that it stands out in nice contrast and has that kind of vibe going with it.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it does. It, for as much as I talk about the desire to kind of dissolve the boundary between the thing, me and the things being imitated, it also kind of points to the difference.
Yeah, it's an intersection.
Mm-hmm.
Into the landscape.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that these can be most successful when they hover right at a really liminal point between that interjecting, which is inevitable, it's always going to be there, and some type of really effective mimesis or rhyming or correspondence with what's in
the
middle.
And just gets us back to your performance question.
Mm-hmm.
Because interjection, in the sense, is always going to be performance.
Mm. Mm.
If you think of it that way.
Yeah.
If you interject, you're performing, because you're not trying to capture, you're trying to throw something into the scene.
Mm.
And so you're working at an interesting intersection there between trying to sort of mute the energy of the interjection, the violence of the alien, and yet also work on its level where it bounces back and corresponds to the very thing it's violating in the same sense.
Oh, that's
and that's a performance right there, if you can imagine it.
I like that thought a lot. Yeah, I'd never thought of it like that before.
Do you bat ready? I think that should do it.
Sure.
That was great.
All right. Thank you, everybody. So much for having me.